Now on Coast to Coast, we're going to talk about the inside the real Area 51. Don Schmidt, Tom Carey back with us on Coast to Coast AM, and we'll get right into this incredible story in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Let me first introduce to you Donald Schmidt, a former co-director of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. He served as director of special investigations for 10 years. Part of that, he was a special investigator for the late Dr. J. Allen Hynek for the International UFO Reporter. And his research became the foundation of the movie Roswell, a film that brought those details of the denial and information of the 1947 case to its largest audience ever. Here's Don Schmidt back on Coast to Coast. Donald, always a pleasure. And Don, you with us?
Yes.
Okay, good to have you with us.
Oh, great to be back, George.
And
always a pleasure.
Tom Carey, of course, has been a Mutual UFO Network state section director in Pennsylvania, special investigator as well for the Dr. J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. And he is, of course, teamed up with Don Schmidt to continue an incredible series of investigations into Roswell, the book Inside the Real Area 51. Hello, Tom.
Hey, George. Good to be with you.
Good. I'm looking forward to this. Don, first and foremost, tell me a little bit about Inside the Real Area 51.
Well, actually, it wasn't the title of the book that we had chosen. The original title was Beneath the Radar, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, because everyone, you know, whether involved with UFO research or not, has this impression, even up to former President Bill Clinton. Movies such as Independence Day have created this, this illusion that all this reverse engineering of captured alien technology is being conducted in the deserts of Nevada. And in reality, it all started in Dayton, Ohio, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Up to this time, Tom and I, for focusing on Roswell and the earlier books, such as Witness to Roswell, We always cut it off where everything is being transported, bodies and the wreckage, all the special flights, everything is going to Wright Field for testing and analysis. And we felt that we needed to pick up where we would always leave off, because we had this growing amount of information, eyewitness testimony, people who were there anticipating the arrival of all this recovered wreckage and remains from Roswell. So this is where the real Area 51, the secret history of Wright-Patterson, takes off.
And Tom, are you two both convinced that whatever happened at Roswell was out of this world?
Absolutely, George. The research that has been done, including our own, I myself, as I sit here, am 99% convinced that what happened at Roswell in 1947 was the crash of an extraterrestrial spaceship with its unfortunate crew, and that everybody that we've talked to who knew where the material and the bodies were taken all pointed to Wright-Patterson, or Wright Field, as it was called in 1947. And there's no doubt about that. And as Don said, the reason our publishers decided on the title The Real Area 51 was because you ask someone on the street, well, have you ever heard of Area 51? And if they have, their response will be, oh, yes, that's where the aliens are.
Yeah.
You're right. They don't know the real history of the Nevada Area 51, but they do know about the aliens. That's what they've heard. So it was sort of a play on words that Wright-Patterson was perhaps the original Area 51 where aliens were taken.
Yeah. Why did they take it so far? I mean, here's the crash in New Mexico, 1947. There were closer areas to go to. Why did they go all the way to Wright-Patterson?
It was the logical choice, George, for the following reason, that Wright-Patterson was the most important, the most secret, the most sophisticated dedicated military facility in our inventory in 1947.
Uh-huh.
It pretty much still is. It was not only the heart of the Air Force, or the Air Corps, as it was called back then, but it was also the brains. During World War II, a lot of things came out of World War II. But during World War II, Wright-Patterson was where all of the Axis or the enemy aircraft that we wanted to find out what made them tick, they were taken to Wright Field for analysis and re-engineering, as we call it. We wanted to find out what their attributes were and how we could defeat them in war. And Wright-Patterson, or Wright Field, they had this hangar, was Hangar 23. It's still there, is where these aircraft were taken for breakdown, for re-engineering, for analysis, and to find out their attributes. It was Hangar 23, which is right next to the so-called Hangar 23, but it was, Building 18, which is most people know as Hangar 18, but it was Building 18. They were connected. So those two facilities were already in business and operating from World War II, so it was only natural that's where the wreckage would go.
Don, was it a running story on the base that something was going on there?
Yes. In fact, even as we have been able to document, even in the press accounts in the aftermath of the very famous press release that went out on July 8th of 1947, that the Army Air Force had actually recovered a flying disc. All the anticipation was that, as Tom described, it was going on. The press release itself stated that it was going on to higher headquarters. Well, the higher headquarters was Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio. Wright was even directly associated with the Roswell Army Airfield, there being the headquarters of the 509 Bomb Group, the first atomic bomb wing in the world. Well, the very bomb racks for those bombs, for those B-29 bombers, were kept at Wright Field. So that in itself was a direct connection to Roswell. But as Tom laid out, even in the press accounts, even with the weather balloon press conference in Fort Worth involving Brigadier General Roger Ramey, he would state to the press that he was canceling the flight to Wright Field, where the materials were originally destined for analysis. Well, we know the flight did continue because, as we will discuss later, there were witnesses, there were personnel, there were officers who we have interviewed who were there on the receiving end, who were there when the materials came in. And then I'm sure we'll be talking about what the conclusions were of the tests that transpired thereafter.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, in your book, again, of course, Inside the Real Area 51, the real area, of course, being Wright-Patterson. What does Wright-Patterson look like now, Don? Is it a shell of itself?
Oh, no. In fact, there are more personnel, more people who are on the payroll who work there than even at the Pentagon. And much of the technology that originated immediately after World War II and the personnel, everything shifted to Wright-Patterson as it became officially an Air Force base. It did much of the original primate, for example, investigation and into crash testing, which would eventually then lead to much of the astronaut training. Ed White trained there. Neil Armstrong trained at Wright-Patterson. So it became more and more instrumental as far as our forthcoming space program. The problem that it is always faced is it's in the heart of Dayton, Ohio. And many of the residents will remember, for example, back in the 60s, just the constant sonic booms as the B-52s would come in and out of the base. And so they're very receptive, very respectful of such a base being in the heart. But as one of the colonels told us, they had a heck of a time transporting material in and out of the base because they'd always have to come through downtown sure. Dayton.
Well, and we know the materials, the retrieved crash sites materials, the bodies went to Wright-Patterson. Where did they go after that?
Are you talking about other bases or on the base?
Other bases, or did they move them around the base?
Well, it's interesting, George. We believe that for the next 35 years after 1947, they remained at Wright-Patterson. And it was only in the early 1980s that we believe that they were moved. The wreckage may have been moved actually to the original area. Well, the real area, you know, you get a play on words here, but to the Area 51 in Nevada.
That's right.
Yes, we believe that the wreckage was moved there for a period, and perhaps the bodies as well. What's interesting about the bodies is that we have several stories that in 1964, several facilities in Texas, most notably Wilford Hall, which is the hospital medical facility at Lackland Air Force Base, which unfortunately I spent one night in Wilford Hall with pneumonia I was in basic training at Lackland in 1963. In 1964, there was a sighting from someone in the Air Force. He was a colonel. He was told to report to Wilford Hall and just observe, and he had no idea what was going on. And lo and behold, he goes into this room that he was assigned to go to, and there's one of the aliens on a gurney, and they're several doctors looking at it and taking notes and what have you. And his role was just to observe. Well, the same year, again, 1964, Randolph Air Force Base in San Antonio, the same as Lackland, which was San Antonio. Another fella, he comes home at night. He was a civilian at Randolph, and he comes home at night all shook up, and his wife says, "What's the matter with you?" And he says, "Well, I was walking down the hallway today in the medical facility, and the door was open, and I just happened to look in, and I saw this little creature, 3.5 to 4 feet tall on a gurney. There were several people in there, and I didn't know what that thing was. It was, you know, it had large head, small body, and, you know, he described what the aliens look like. And there was one other sighting again in 1964 in Texas. So we know, it suggests to us that the bodies at least were loaned around to various aeromedical facilities within the military for observation or continued analysis.
I wonder where they are today. That's the big question.
Well, we've had a reason to believe, because we've had not only a first-hand witness, we've both interviewed a retired colonel who was at Dugway in Utah, which is the military's aeromedical biological research facility.
Sure is.
And even the late Colonel George Weinbrenner, who was head of Foreign Technology Division at Wright Field. In fact, he was, as it turns out, he was even the late Dr. Jalen Hynek, the founder and the scientific director of the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago. He was Hynek's boss when Hynek still served as a consultant.
The Blue Book.
At Blue Book, correct, and a few years thereafter. And before Weinbrenner died, he passed on to his private nurse the message that he should get word to Robert Emmenegger, who's the documentary producer who wrote the book UFOs, Future, Past, Present, and Future. And Emmenegger had been asked by the Air Force to produce a documentary on UFOs back in the 1970s. And his contact at Wright-Patt was Colonel George Weinbrenner. Well, anyway, the message from Weinbrenner before he died was, we have five bodies in Utah. Well, I had mentioned that to Colonel Robert Friend, who was the second last director of Project Blue Book.
And you think he was forthcoming with you?
And, well, to some degree, but what was interesting that his immediate reaction was, yes, Dugway, that would make perfect sense if we had bodies.
And he quoted a kind of like quote, if, unquote?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about Friend, he happened to be at Wright Field when the materials came in. Now, we did not know this. I don't think anybody in the UFO community ever bothered to even ask, Colonel, where were you at the time of the Roswell incident? Well, he happened to be at Wright Field. And he described to us how, yes, we were prepped. We were informed the materials from Roswell were indeed coming in. Well, Colonel, if it was merely a weather balloon, if it was merely a mogul, you know, weather balloon device, any type of off-the-shelf balloon material, why would it come to Wright Field for any type of testing and analysis? Well, it wasn't any type of balloon. That I'm even sure of.
That's now, amazing.
Now, Colonel Friend believes it was a broken arrow, that it was an errant atomic bomb. Well, that's impossible because after the two bombs were dropped in Japan, Little Boy and Fat Man, we didn't really have any in our arsenal at that time.
I think it was just those two weapons, wasn't it?
That was correct. And in fact, even in all the test dropping, the target dropping that Roswell continued thereafter, surrounding the city of Roswell, they were using sand barrels of equivalent weight. So it's interesting that even one of the former directors of Blue Book doesn't believe it was any type of balloon. He still believes it was something extraordinary, something exotic, something beyond the pale. He can't prove it. Anything but extraterrestrial, as we often say. But nonetheless, he also disagrees with the Air Force's official explanation of the crash at Roswell.
I've always marveled, though, at how, with incredible technology, they could get here and then get into an accident and crash and burn, basically. How does that happen?
Well, George, we believe it or not, we get that question many times. And our answer is, well, our answer is twofold. Well, it did happen. And the real answer is that anything manufactured has a tensile strength, whether it was manufactured on Earth or elsewhere,
right.
It has a tensile strength. And what happened at Roswell, well, actually, northwest of Roswell in July of 1947. It was either an internal explosion, because we're speculating here. We don't really know, but we speculate that it was either an internal explosion or something external like a lightning strike. During the month of July in southeastern central New Mexico, it's what they call the monsoon season mm-hmm. there. And if you've ever been there during that time and you see these lightning storms, thunder and lightning, it's not necessarily rain all the time,
right.
But certainly lightning, you have never seen anything like that.
They're
you can just imagine if something like that perhaps hit one of the ships, one of the extraterrestrial ships, perhaps, you know, something there malfunctioned and it exploded. We do have witnesses. Unfortunately, they're gone now, as are most of the witnesses, that did report hearing a muffled explosion in between thunderclaps of a severe lightning storm on the evening of July the 2nd, 1947.
We're going to come back with both of you in a moment. Don Schmidt, Tom Carey with us as we talk about Inside the Real Area 51. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Don Schmidt, Tom Carey with us as we talk. This is an incredible story. Don, both you and Tom, you had an association with J. Allen Hynek, who made that big shift from his Project Blue Book days to his own UFO study center in Chicago. What did he ever say about the Roswell case? Let's start with you, Don.
Well, we were surprised that within a year after he passed away in 1985, that he left not only as part of his personal files, his personal notes, we found all types of handwritten notes. And most people aren't aware that when Dr. Hynek had retired from Northwestern University, back at the time of the beginning of Project Sign, he was at Ohio State, so it was convenient. He was just down the road over in Columbus, down the road from Dayton, Ohio. And he would become head of the astronomy department at Northwestern in Evanston, Illinois. And when he retired, they had willed him an old abandoned observatory in western New Mexico. So they moved out to Scottsdale, Arizona, where he would live out the rest of his life. Well, anyway, as he would get into New Mexico, he made his way to the high desert portion of Lincoln County.
Mm-hmm.
And we discovered that he was interviewing ranchers, hired hands, neighbors, people who lived out in that region who were involved back in 1947 with the Roswell incident. And he was talking to the very people that we would eventually have the same opportunity with. And he would write at the top, this needs to be investigated. This needs to be followed up on. And Hynek himself was becoming more and more interested in crash retrieval cases.
Would you say he was obsessed with it?
Well, I think as so often when I would be with him in the field, and he would always make that remark, I'm an old man in a hurry. I'm an old man in a hurry. And I can't imagine reaching that point in your life that you feel that you still have so much unaccomplished. Your mission in life is still undone.
Right, frustrating.
And this was his mission in life. He felt in many ways that the Air Force had not taken him in to the inner sanctum, so to speak. He was not told. He would often talk about how all the hardcore cases that the Air Force received were not part of the Blue Book system. He would often speak with pilots, both commercial and military, out in the field. And when he would get to Wright Pat to look through the Blue Book files, none of those cases were ever there. They wouldn't acknowledge being even recipients to such sighting reports. So it was frustrating for him. And it was that slow conversion when he realized and when he finally accepted, all these people just can't be lying. And then when he had such cases as the famous Socorro incident, again, in New Mexico, of all places.
That's with the police officer. Great story.
Precise. Lonnie Zamora, 1964. And that's what finally started to convince him. And as he displayed to me the very last time I was with him, and he pounded his fist on the table, George, and he said, Don, it's smacking more and more of nuts and bolts. And I think, as you ask, that's why he became all the more intrigued with the crash retrieval incident. Mm-hmm. The idea that maybe all this time we've had physical evidence in our possession and they couldn't even show me, they couldn't even confide to me, and I was right there at Wright-Patterson.
All right, Tom, how about you?
Yes, George, I never knew and never met personally Alan Hynek, so I could only speak of my remembrances of what he had done. And I had always considered him I don't mean to disparage him, but from my perspective, that he was a dupe of the Air Force, and that they were using him to explain away UFO sightings. And he was an astronomer, as Don said, at Ohio State and Northwestern, so he had credibility. And he was used to explain away UFOs as astronomical, events, planet Venus, solar flares, bolides, that sort of thing. Well, lo and behold, this is 1966 now, going into the drugstore to get something, and I see this, I think it was the Saturday Evening Post. Don can correct me if I'm not getting it right, but I saw this big headline on the Saturday Evening Post of this pro-UFO article, and it was authored by J. Allen Hynek. So by 1966, this is now December of 66, he had flipped, as we say. So there was something in there that was going on. He had finally had enough, and he had come over to the, you know, the side of light.
It was dramatic.
One of the cases that I believe caused him to throw up his hands, that what was going on and what he was part of was almost a fiasco, was the famous, and the term is still with us today,
Swamp gas.
Yep. And we always called him Old Swampy. There were these sightings in Michigan, Hillsdale, Dexter, of several nights in 1965.
I was there as a teenage boy, fascinated with UFOs, Tom and Don. And when Heine came to Michigan, I mean, I just thought this was it. This is real. And then when he said swamp gas, a disappointment. Well, he was kind of forced to say that, wasn't he?
Well, no.
Yes,
well,
he was. If I might interject for a moment, because it was something that he always wound up having to apologize for. But as you both have been describing those sightings in Michigan at that time, he was besieged by the press the moment he got off the plane, because they were physically grabbing him. They wanted to know, as far as once and for all, what the Air Force not only had been hiding, but what were these sightings that were presently taking place in Michigan. And he only addressed one specific witness who he had interviewed, and it was a farmer near a marsh area, a swamp area, and he came up with the explanation for one sole incident during a whole series of sightings that it could possibly be marsh gas, swamp gas. And that was the final straw with the press. And as Tom and
you told George,
they ran with that. And that's where the Air Force found themselves in a truly dire situation. And that's where they looked for their scapegoat, and that being the Condon Commission, serving as a civilian investigative body, to basically gave them an escape from investigating the phenomenon.
Yeah, it was truly a whitewash, I think.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And in fact, what's interesting, in our Roswell investigation, we have through the years been able to speak with firsthand witnesses. We talked about the assimilation, the testing of the materials immediately after 1947. And we have found places such as Battelle Institute and RAND Corporation, General Electric, Hughes Aircraft, and the Bureau of Standards who were involved in this testing. Well, who was the head of the Bureau of Standards back in 1947, immediately after Roswell, but Edward Condon, who was assigned to provide the Air Force with their cop-out, with their escape mechanism for finally bowing out of the UFO investigation, head of the Condon Committee in 1966.
You know, with all that has been going on in the past and all that's going on in the future, it seems to me, Don and Tom, that in the past, there seems to have been more interest in UFOs in terms of media coverage, with some seriousness. I mean, they even covered George Adamski things like that. But now it seems to have changed a little bit. Now it seems a little more like, it's those people.
You know, what's interesting, George, is that today I think there are many more sites. I mean, everybody seems to have one of the, I don't have one, these little cameras in their cell phone, and they're taking pictures of everything, and they have these video cameras, and there's all sorts of sightings that they have recorded. Now, back in the day, and I'm talking about the late 40s and 1950s, they didn't have the technology that we have today, where sightings can be fabricated. Let's face it, you could. Do wonders with computers. And I'm thinking that some of these cases today, like the Phoenix Lights and the Stevensville, Texas, and a few others, to me seem like solid cases. Why haven't these, sort of tipped the balance to where, it's, this does it, this proves it. I don't have an explanation other than the media. I'm talking about the mainstream media now. You know, you're talking your three networks, CNN and what have you, not the cable channels, but the commercial channels. They have decided that the subject of UFOs, they do not want to cover those because they depend upon their livelihoods for their credibility.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're covering the president, if you're covering world affairs,
you can't cover a UFO.
You cannot cover UFOs because you will lose your credibility. And the same with your political people. You don't want to be there goes Senator UFO. You just don't
That's
want
right.
that attached to your name.
Larry,
and I believe it goes back to the 1950s. If you're old enough, you remember the so-called contactees, and we're still living with carrying the burden that these contactees who fabricated these stories are being whisked around the solar system by their Venusian space brothers. We are still dealing with the legacy of those hoaxers in this particular field of endeavor, unfortunately.
Larry King might have been the only media person who would be able to cross that line both ways, you know, hard news and also UFOs in the way he did it. And the primary reason he was able to do that was when he was doing his late night radio show on the Mutual Radio Network.
That's right.
He
yes.
covered those a lot. And, you know, we just flowed into that. So, you know, it's something like what I would do. I definitely would insist that we would cover these kinds of stories again. I know.
Well, in many ways, Larry was then a, you know, followed up as far as in the legend of Long John Neville.
That's right.
Who would provide a forum.
Neville was the first.
He was the first. And then King, and then as far as
then
Art. And then yourself, George. So we've often pointed out that if there's anything late breaking, anything that has happened ufological around the world, it's going to be on George tonight.
We will get you. That's right.
That's correct. And that's the advantage you have, and it's wonderful that not only the audience that you're able to present the late breaking information regarding the subject, but that you're able to provide us with a forum. As far as that, we're able to come in from the field, so to speak. We come in from the trenches and report to the troops. And it's something, unfortunately, as both you and Tom have been describing, that the media has been long indoctrinated. It has become a taboo topic. And sad, for example, a year ago when we had the citizens' hearings in Washington, where we testified for 5 days to those six former congresspeople, and very little coverage by the media. And for all of the press conferences at the National Press Club, even involving retired officers, whether involved with nuclear test facility incidents and other officer incidents, the press just will not touch this. It always comes back to what does this journalist know that this full-bird colonel doesn't know? And I think that's where...
Yep.
The brainwashing, if we would like to even use that word, truly has had its long-lasting effect to our detriment, truly.
So, a recent example, George, of the effect of what we've been talking about upon political people in the 2008 election, the Democratic primary, you had Dennis Kucinich running he was a candidate for president.
That's right.
And at one point, one of the reporters got a hold of this story where Kucinich apparently had a pretty good sighting, a UFO sighting. I think it was up in Washington State. He was visiting Shirley MacLaine, the actress, and he had a sighting.
That's right.
And the reporter asked him about this UFO sighting. Well, after that, that's all the reporters wanted to talk about with him. And he was sort of, that was it for him as far as his candidacy. He withdrew shortly thereafter because in the mind's eye of the public, he was not credible because he had had, of all things, oh my goodness, a UFO sighting, and he was willing to talk about it. So that's the prime example recently of why the mainstream media will not touch this subject.
Well, we had Shirley MacLaine on the show several months ago, and she had a coughing attack, and I had to get her off the air. I mean, it was so bad. I thought she was going to choke to death on the air.
My goodness.
But she was she's a great interview.
We've done her own radio, her own show a number of times in the past. So no talking, no coughing incidents.
No. Well, back to Wright-Patterson now. So in your opinion, and you're going to have to guess, I guess, and speculate on this. I would assume we still have these bodies hermetically sealed somewhere, don't we?
Yes. One of the early stories that we got was that a fellow back in the late 40s worked in Building 18F. Now, there's a whole complex of Building 18, starting with Building 18, Building 18A through G or H. Well, Building 18F had these vents coming out of it. And he said that on warm days in the summer, these strange smells started wafting up and made him sick. Well, this Building 18F was the cold storage facility. And this is pre-air conditioning, you know, before everything became air conditioned. Well, it suggests that that's where the bodies were stored for a while. Well, later witnesses talked about having seen bodies in these cryogenic suspension tubes. They were glass, plexiglass, or what have you. Inadvertently, they'd be in the particular location, or they'd been taken there on purpose, and they were in cryogenic suspension. So it did evolve from just being on ice, as the saying goes, to a more sophisticated means of storage. Now, where they are at the moment, George, I could not tell you, because we've heard so many stories about, well, I saw them here, I saw them there. It does suggest to us that they have been loaned around over the years, but they are still somewhere, and perhaps at the, I hate to say the real area, but the original, the Area 51 in Nevada, let's call it, they've been reported there. So right now, your guess is as good as mine, but they're somewhere.
Why do you think that wherever they came from, that their colleagues, didn't come back for them?
It's interesting that even our good friend, the son of General Nathan Twining Jr., described to us an incident involving his father, who was head of Air Materiel Command at Wright-Patterson, at Wright Field shortly after the incident, and that there was an infiltration, according to Nate Jr., that there was an unknown that came over the base, aircraft were scrambled, and Twining's father, the general, was involved, and according to him, was in a car on the radio racing towards the radar tower, yelling, "Get my boys out of there, get them out of there right now,"
wow,
as though he knew that they were dealing with something superior, something that they could not defend themselves at that time. Even at the time of the incident back in New Mexico, when the famous meteor expert, Dr. Lincoln LaPaz, was assigned, when he arrived from Washington with the assignment to determine the speed and trajectory at Roswell, they interviewed the ranchers and they talked about seeing a lot of unknowns shining probes of light, spotlights, down onto the desert floor, as though they were looking for something.
Good point. We're going to come back. We're going to talk more. Dawn and Tom, I want to ask you if you think that these ETs could be dangerous. And then we'll take calls next on Coast to Coast AM.